are people, customers, going to have conversations with AI bots?
Artificial intelligence is going to enable people to, you'd have a bot, and if they're good, be able to have the earlier, simpler sales process or the earlier, maybe beginning phases of things. However, those things have an Achilles heel because they have to be trained on whatever's currently been written. They're not going to come up with any new brilliant idea. Only human beings can identify the essential characteristics of something in reality and come up with a new theory that will actually be better.
Well,
Bots are going to just repeat what they've read before in different
that
words.
assumes that that limitation can't be overcome. But I could actually see a day where procurement has a con a procure procurement bot has a conversation with a sales rep bot, and people aren't even involved.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, my guest is Michael Webb, president of Sales Performance Consultants, a consultancy to those companies who want to improve their marketing and sales results. Michael is an internationally known author and management consultant. His specialty is bringing data-driven management approaches to sales and marketing organizations. His approach recognizes the critical role beliefs play in behaviors of sales and marketing people, as well as customers. He engages frontline salespeople, managers, and executives, as well as cross-functional teams. His 2006 book, Sales and Marketing, The Six Sigma Way, earned 4.5 stars on Amazon and sold more than 21,000 copies. And his 2014 book, Sales Process Excellence, earned the prestigious Shingo Research Award in 2015. Welcome, Michael. Welcome to my podcast. Great to have you on.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, we've known each other for quite some time. In fact, I think that we met for our first time at an OPEX, Operational Excellence Society chapter meeting in Atlanta some,
yep.
Geez, darn, it's got to be a decade if it's a day.
Yes, it was. It was 10 years ago. We were having regular meetings. I love those kind of meetings. I've been a member of a couple of those kind of groups here locally and back in Chicago when I lived there. It's too bad we don't have them much anymore.
Yeah, well, I think, COVID disrupted a whole lot of things, but, that get-together kind of faded away even before before COVID, so we can't blame COVID on it. Just putting on those meetings is a lot of effort, though, right? I mean, you have to, find a venue, find a speaker, one person could never make the chapter work. So, but I enjoyed meeting you in our conversations. One of the things that struck me, and it still strikes me to this day, is continuous improvement, operational excellence with respect to sales and marketing, which is in your domain, which is your purview, which is your expertise, if you will. And the reason I've had such challenges with operational excellence and continuous improvement and applying it to sales and marketing is because it's so amorphous, if you will. I mean, no two salespeople, there's just a lot of personalities involved, especially, in sales. I mean, no two salespeople are going to have the same personality, the same approach, have the same kind of conversations with a prospective customer. One could turn a customer on and the next one from the same company can turn a customer completely off. And not to mention that I've never met a salesperson that likes to write down anything, okay? God forbid you get them to feeding a beast of some sort, the CRM system. And right. The same goes with marketing. I mean, with marketing, you can measure some level of effectiveness. If you buy an ad, for instance, you could see how many people click through and whatnot. You might even be able to see how many people viewed the ad. But, there's so much less that it's telling you, especially if you're in the knowledge industry like you and I are, okay? It's like if I see an ad for a cool technical gadget, I might click on it because I like cool technical gadgets. Mm-hmm. Or if I see a picture of a hut in Tahiti, you know, on the beach. I might click on that because that's where I'd like to be right now instead of in Germany during the winter time. But, you know, if you're selling like continuous improvement, why would anybody ever click on that, right? So, you know, this is your domain. I'm confessing all of my my sins here and my misconceptions. You know, what am I missing?
Well, I guess a bunch of things. From one point of view, you know, I've never met a sales organization and the salespeople have a lot of problems. They are struggling. Sometimes the problems are out in the market. Sometimes their plant can't ship. Sometimes, you know, the competition is eating them alive. Their regime can change because they got a new vice president of sales. And they know that things should be better and could be better. But they're sort of stuck in this spider web, you know, of the way policies are and the way people's beliefs are. And as a result, nothing improves. So from a salesperson's standpoint, a lot of struggles, a lot of frustration. You know, I remember my dawning of this whole idea, this whole thing about process improvement and lean was back in the 1990s. I was a first-line sales manager for Rockwell Automation at the time. They divided the sales managers into specialty market areas, and mine was operator interface and information systems connected to the factory, right? Well, they had a Deming consultant go around to all the branch offices, and we offered for free a full day of statistical process control training for all of our customers because Rockwell was trying to move away from strictly providing basically PLCs to the automotive industry. It was Allen Bradley, right? To being the whole tinker toy set for all of factory automation. So there was the food industry, the pharmaceutical industry, all these other verticals they wanted to get into. So they were trying to educate their customers, the manufacturing plants, that they needed data and they could use that data to improve. Well, the afternoon of that day was the red bead experiment. I'd heard of Deming a little, okay. But he if you know what the red bead experiment is, I think you probably do.
Yeah,
no?
Yeah. Okay, I mean, well, but my audience, you know, the audience might not.
Okay, so he is up on stage. Deming wasn't there. This consultant was there doing the red bead experiment. You can learn about it on YouTube. There's a bunch of good YouTubes about it. But he is playing like they're a company. There's a CEO. There's a vice president of quality. There's a production manager. And they bring people from the audience up on the stage to perform some work. And they give them a process to follow, the steps to follow. And as they go through the first round, they start charting the data on these big easel pads. And, you know, some of the people made more good parts than others. All they're really doing is sticking a paddle in a bowl with red beads and white beads. And they're counting the red beads because those are defects. And so some people really did well, not very many red beads. And other people didn't do so well, too many red beads. So they go chide the ones that didn't do as well and pat the ones on the back that did do so well. And they said, now let's do this again and see if everybody can do better. Lo and behold, some of the people who did well the next time didn't do so well. What happened? You stopped paying attention? Follow the process, right? Well, what he's demonstrating is there's a process that is not capable of producing what the company wants. But the managers of the company aren't aware of systems thinking and stuff like that. So they're thinking, well, maybe we didn't tell you what the goal was. That's what the problem is. So everybody, here's what your quota. This is your goal, right? Do another round. That doesn't work. Well, maybe we need to reward the ones, right? Whoa, great. Okay, so they go another round. They start handing out dollar bills. And geez, some of the ones who did well before now aren't doing so well. Okay, all right, look, we're just going to have to, you're on probation now. We're going to have to fire you if you don't improve your performance. So they go through these iterations and it ends up with their changing reorg. You know, the VP of production is now going to be the VP of quality and they're moving the tables around. And what you realize going through this is, wait a second, I've seen this before. This is my life. in sales. We work our asses off, and sometimes we make it and we're heroes. Sometimes we don't, and we're schmucks. What? Wait a second. So that got me hooked on this idea that there's data out there. The user in the factory, you know, you can see how using that evidence and data drives the ability to redesign the system to eliminate waste, increase throughput, increase quality. But in sales, man, it's just work harder. Do more proposals, right? That's all it ever was. So there had to be something in there. So that's what got me hooked. And over time, I realized that, you know, there's some self-limiting beliefs that people bring. And this is operational excellence and engineering kind of mentalities, as well as sales and marketing. They bring some limiting, self-limiting beliefs. So as an example, in engineering and in operational excellence in particular, and Six Sigma in really particular, you know, they're interested in eliminating defects, lean waste, right? Wants to get rid of it. But, you know, in sales, what's waste? How do you know? It's just somebody's opinion, right? And why aren't salespeople more motivated by this cool logical improvement stuff? Well, they're not motivated because they're fundamentally not interested in that problem. They want to find out what'll make money. They want to find out what the customer wants to buy. They're looking for value, not waste. So in operational excellence, we're taught, you know, value is that which the customer won't pay for.
Non-value is what the customer...
That's right, right. Non-value. Yeah, waste. No, right. I'm sorry, I got waste. It back.
Yeah.
What the customer won't pay for. In sales, by definition, you don't know what the customer is going to pay for anyway. Right? You got to figure that out if you can. And so this idea that it's all about eliminating defects is a fundamental error. It introduces a lot of blind spots because you cannot define a defect or waste if you don't know what the value is in the first place. The value is... what waste is not value, right? So what we really need to be doing is identifying how do we define value? What's the operational definition of value, right? That opens up the opportunity to use all this analytical, scientific stuff, ideas and mental processes, reason, right? To create value, not just stop wasting things. So that's going to get salespeople's attention. Go ahead.
So I got, you know, backed up with several questions now. And I'm going to just, you know, we're talking about sales and we're talking about marketing. I'm going to restrict these questions to sales because there's, in my opinion, there's two different worlds there. So I'm in the middle of watching the series Mad Men again. Okay. And you know, obviously there's sales and there's marketing in one show. And it takes place in the 60s. I don't know if you're familiar with this show or not, but
I've heard of it. I haven't watched it.
So it's really fascinating because, you know, the sales process and this, you know, maybe I'm an old school, maybe I, you know, in a different era, you know, it's about relationships. Okay. You know, before you can get the customer to open up to you and actually tell you, you know, what keeps them up at night, what, you know, how they can be helped by you, you have to gain their trust because they're not going to just open up to anybody and on the street and say, hey, you know, I got all these problems. So you really have to, you know, build a relationship before that honest conversation can start happening.
Yep.
But it gets to that point where what's the question?
What's the question?
Well, the question that I have is how do we put that into a process, and how do we then, like, do I go back to my CRM and say, listen, I had a great conversation with Michael today. We decided we're going to go out for a golf outing next weekend. I mean, does that belong in the CRM system? Does that have to be fed? So I guess in the process, what I'm trying to get to is how granular is the process, and does the process, is it designed just to serve the sales rep and their objective, Or is there some interface or integration between what the sales rep's activities are, the outcome, and what management, quote unquote management, needs in order to monitor the progress and the health of their sales force?
Okay. So several questions that you're asking buried in one right? Let's go back to the relationship thing. Okay. You start talking to someone you haven't met before and you build a relationship. What does that mean? What's happening in the customers, between the customers' ears as they start saying, I like this guy. I trust this guy. What's happening?
Yeah, well, you just said it, trust and understanding. You know, before I could go further, I have to be able to trust you as a person that you're ethical. Right. Okay. Right. And I have to trust you in your wisdom that you're going to share, that if you don't know, you're going to be able to be honest and upfront enough to tell me, I don't know, but I'll find that answer. Okay.
That's
so,
so there's
the trust about,
every salesperson knows they have to get the customer's attention, have to get his information, have to earn his trust long before he's ever going to get a chance to earn the money.
Right. I agree with that.
But what most salespeople don't realize is that that's a value chain, right? You're doing things to earn that customer's judgment there, right? That's a process that takes place in between people all the time.
Right.
It's a process that requires skill and practice, right?
I'll say being genuine to yourself. Nobody likes a fake person, right?
Oh, no question about that. And so a lot of the problem comes in because we've sort of been taught that whatever we think about, whatever goes on inside the human brain, that's subjective. You can't analyze it. Nothing could be further from the truth. And we can't avoid analyzing what we ourselves think and what other people think. We do it every day, all the time, right? Whether you're a business or a human being or any living thing, you face a choice. You do the right thing and you're going to survive and thrive, maybe. You do the wrong thing, it's going to hurt you and you might die, ultimately, right? At the far extremes. Well, how do we do that? It's based on what we understand about the world. We have to perceive the world. We're taught that if it's physical and you can measure it with a number, then you can know what it is. Okay, but when we're growing up as little kids, you know, we push the dinner plate off the high chair and it crashes and we do it again. And so we're learning how the physical world works. We learn balls roll, right? Fire burns paper. If I pull the tail on the dog, something's going to happen. Now, wait a second. The dog tries to bite me. That's bad, right? You have propositional knowledge that you build and it's equally They're equal. You have to have propositional knowledge about how the physical world works and propositional knowledge about what's good for you or bad for you, right? So your emotions are triggers to what is value out there. If you go through experiences and you decide anytime I touch a dog, it's bad, and so for the rest of your life you've got a phobia against dogs, right? Then you have sort of limited yourself. But it's a thinking process that we go through. And all of us human beings have done that to some extent. The issue is that we haven't necessarily taken on the practice of trying to integrate everything over time, right? Thinking about ourselves, why did I feel that way in that situation? If you figure that out about yourself and you meet someone else who seems to be exhibiting a behavior, now you have something to draw on to understand them, right? It's called empathy. And if you think about one last point here, and I'll tie this all together. When you learn mathematics, arithmetic in grade school, and you learn about the scientific method, you are learning self-awareness. And in order to be a good mathematician or scientist, you learn all the way through college, right? I have to be alert to myself. Do I really know this or don't I? And I have to bring my knowledge back in line with reality. Well, you do the same thing about your own emotions and deciding what's value out in the world and what isn't. You need that to infer what other people are thinking. It's inference there, just like it's inference when you're dealing with mathematics or science. So there should be no limitation saying, well, anything that happens between people is subjective. People buy based on emotions. You can't analyze or forecast that. No, you can, you must. And it's iterative, just like in science. You can learn better and better how it works.
Okay, so there are a couple of things that I got to unpack here. The first is that I'm hearing about a process that the salesperson lives by. I believe that you could train some of it, but you can't train all of it. I mean, there's got to be some. I mean, there's a reason I'm not on the golf pro tour, all right? Because no matter how much I practice, I'm going to suck still, okay? However, if I am good enough to be on the tour, I could improve it with some coaching and some understanding and some observations about my process.
Sure,
to improve
that's
that
true for any profession, engineering, playing the piano, I mean, anything.
Super. So, you know, one of the things that I've been in business since 1985, and one of the things that I've learned is never have the customer waiting on you. Always make sure that the customer is waiting on the competition. So if they need demos, if they need references, if they need anything, I want to be able to, at a button, just get it to them, a physical button or a figurative button. It doesn't matter. I just want to be able to get it to them because they're eventually going to come to realize that they're always waiting on the other guys, not me. All right. But then, even then, sometimes when you win, it's a hollow victory. I'm going to share with you a story that I rarely tell anybody because, you know, why would I? I won this big project. This is probably a good decade and a half ago. It was going to set up our entire year. It was a big ERP project. And so I'm sitting with the CFO of the company as we're signing contracts. And he says, you know why I went with you guys? And I'm like, geez, it must have been like the best demos, best due diligence. And this is what he said to me. He looks at me, he says, I know that I'm going to get fucked in this project, but I think you guys are going to fuck me the least. And all I could say to that is thank you. And it drove me insane. You know, like on the way, another hour and a half, I'm driving home. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm hating myself, you know. But here it is. You know, obviously, in this particular case, sometimes the sales process is a big open lie. Okay. The customer thinks that they're going to allocate more resources than they can, that they're more capable than they are. And so they say, we're going to take all this and we'll do this part ourselves. And you guys will just do this little piece. And of course, when we get involved, then our little piece grows and grows and grows. And then you get the impression of what's actually going on. But, you know, here it is 15 years later and we're still in business together, right? We're still, because we did establish that trust. And even though I hated him for saying it, it was true. You know, I mean, I've never seen a project, one of these projects that were on time, on budget, and fulfilled everything as they said they were going to do, because it's just not possible, because there's just all of these open nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of lies that are being told.
So a couple observations make that last point. How well did that executive and his people know themselves?
Oh, they knew themselves, but not necessarily what they're capable of doing, okay,
right,
or how much time they had to allocate.
Which is why outside expertise was of value, right? Okay. So, I mean, the observation you're making is very true, not just about Lean or Six Sigma or operational excellence projects not achieving their goals. It's very common that happens. I was shocked when I joined the sales training industry a long time ago. The sales training industry had the same problems as the Six Sigma training industry, right? So it's sales training, it's CRM, it's any kind of management consulting or intervention. There's very low rates of success in those things. And I would submit that what we're really trying to do is bring reason to solving business problems, and that half the problem is between our own ears, understanding ourselves, understanding why we're doing things, understanding what the real values are, and helping other people to learn and get better, right? You started to ask a question before about the sales process. How granular does it have to be? The answer is that in fact, the process is not what people do. It's what they think. It's what they believe, because that's what they're going to gravitate to doing anyway. A good manager has to get them to expose, articulate what they believe, and then help them test it with evidence and data, right? So the amount of information you have to put in a CRM is whatever's the minimum. The documentation you give people about doing their process, a sales process, is whatever's the minimum they actually need that they will use that will help them do the experiments to get better and better. They're the ones who own the problem of winning the customer, and they're the ones who have to change their behaviors. And the manager's the one who has to see, well, this stuff over here is nothing that they can control. But if we don't solve it, we're never going to make progress. So management has to change that while the salespeople change the things that they can control. So,
okay. So let's get out of the ethereal and get into the forensic. Okay. The salesperson has a sales process. Maybe that's universally accepted, that process. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's adaptable. But the salesperson has a process. They're going to go through a series of steps. Each step is basically promoting the relationship from one level of intimacy to another level of intimacy to another level of intimacy until they find a commonality where the salesperson can actually help the prospect with the stuff that they do, with the value that they're able to drive.
Or recognize that they can't.
That they can't, which, by the way, is a great opportunity to build trust, too, because if you can't do it and you know that can, you do the referral, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, I like to think of myself as a Shell Answer guy. Now, you're old enough to remember, I think, who the Shell Answer guys were. And basically, if I don't know it, I know somebody that does. Yeah. And I have no problems with getting those eyes on and just referring out and I do accounts this time. But I think that as a salesperson, that gives that salesperson more value because mm-hmm. incrementally you're building that trust, you're building that intimacy. The person knows that that it's no longer about I'm just trying to sell you whatever it is that I can sell you. I'm trying to help you. You know what I mean?
You're absolutely true about those things, but you have to remember that what passes for salesmanship in one industry doesn't even look like salesmanship in another.
Right. Right.
There's all kinds of cases where companies are trying to grow. I had a very good client that became almost a billion-euro company in the HVAC industry. Because I had these great technical products and they found a way to sell through to OEMs, right? So in the OEM business, the salesperson's highly technical. He gets himself engineered into the customer's bill of material. And then he's the answer man from then on, making sure that all the rev levels match the changes in the customer and the stuff comes in on time and all, right?
Right, now, right.
This company also, they made products that you could sell through OEMs, but they also, these products could be sold to the building trades industry. Well, building trades is a whole different kettle of fish, right? Because you have the building owners. A foundation that owns a hospital, right? You have the architects and engineers who design various kinds of buildings like hospitals. You have the contracting firms. You have the dealers and distributors who supply those guys. Well, there's four or five different parts of the market channel who don't give a crap about technology, right? They want the benefit that the technology can provide, but you can't sell to them the same way. So the client had been trying to get into this building trades industry for 10 years. And they're using all the best stuff that they knew how to do in the OEM side of it, but it was a brick wall. So we had to take them through a structured way of discovering voice of the customer, which means the salespeople had to be able to go in and ask questions in a different way of different people than they had before. Had the little training was required. So they started doing that, and we started recording the information. There's structured ways to do all this stuff. And when you ask the customer what was important about the kind of supplier we are, and you ask them to compare you to other people, and you ask them to put numbers on it, you know, rank it, wow, not a single one of those customers said technology. Every word out of our marketing department's mouth is about our technology, right? Ooh, that was a big shock. And so as you learn what is valued by these different parts of the market channel, then you realize I have to talk to them about different things. We use that to design a sales process. And in the first 6 months of applying that sales process, where they zero it in on the right kind of customer, the right kind of dealer, the right kind of opportunity, all of this was observable, by the way. The salespeople would get together and define the observable things that made one of these opportunities more or less likely to be successful with them, or, you know, customer to buy. And, you know, immediately, first 6 months, the mean productivity of this little group of salespeople went up over 40%. And the variability of their revenue per month went down by almost 50%, right? Had a case study about that. And it's just because nobody had taught the salespeople how to operationally define this stuff. In any process with any team, there has to be respectful agreement about the best way to do the work. And in sales, the work is much more abstract and using inference, right? Because you have to be thinking about other people. But nonetheless, those people do things for a reason. And you need to divine what those reasons are and test those theories. And when you do that, you're taking such a different approach to sales, it can be dramatically successful.
So I understand now, you know, the sales, from the salesperson's perspective, you used the word recording earlier. I'm sure that you didn't mean physically like recording audio and video, because I think that a customer would probably be put off by that. But you meant like capturing the information and putting it someplace. Now,
but it has to be the stuff that's going to be useful to the salesperson.
Useful to the salesperson. Yeah. But how about, let's flip it a bit, management. How does I could be a salesperson and I could be, you know, have my little notebook and I could be writing things down about my clients and my meetings and what have you. but that's good for me. But what about management? You know, if we can't standardize the notes and what the notes mean, it's going to be very, very challenging to apply any analysis to it. So there's got to be ways for management to understand what the progress is in various opportunities, so that they could maybe coach the sales rep if they see the sales, one opportunity is stalled in a certain stage or whatever. How do we reconcile that? Because, of course, sales reps don't like to share anything either. You know, not so much that they're keeping it to themselves, but they just don't like administrative work, because that's taking them away from energy.
Who does like administrative work? I mean, the least of it you can do, away with, is what will help. But the thing is, and here's where you get to, especially in sales, there's this misconception about the process. The process is best practices, right? The process is what the people believe. That's what's going to dictate their behaviors. So you have to get in their heads, bring the team together and ask them, because what they all agree on is what they're going to try to act on. And when those actions don't produce the improvement or the changes that they expected, manager's in a great position. Now, why do you think that happened? Would you like some help with that, or do you have some ideas, right? You'll be surprised what people come up with if you are respectful of what they're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. If you are trying to say, like, I want you to be following the challenger sales process here. What is your challenge going to be on every single one of your customers? Or, what I want you to do a stand-up presentation. Once worked for a sales training company that was big on that, right? We want every person to do a stand-up presentation to their customer. It's like I heard the president of a U.S. arm of this European company telling his sales manager, I want you to follow the lean process. And he gave them a lean project plan and apply it somehow to sales. It's like, you're dictating to them what you think so you can go do something else. You should be, as a manager, pulling from them what does their thinking make sense? Does it make sense to them? What are they concerned about? That's where the action is. And out of that comes, it's easy to come up with standardization. I mean, when I work with salespeople, and I wrote about this in chapter 3 of my book, Sales Process Excellence, you can get them in a room and start prompting them to identify the observable things that make a prospect more or less likely to buy from them, okay? And as they come up with those things, you know, the youngsters, new ones in, are listening in. Ooh, I didn't know. That's an interesting way to look at it, right? And the old guys are even learning from each other. And you can put a structure to this. So the example I often use is, like, in professional selling, you know that you have to build a coach network, like you were talking about before, earn the trust of people in different parts of the organization, hopefully up and down the hierarchy. Well, there's ways to do that. So we ask them, we asked one of my clients what these were. They came up with them, and we were able to put it in a numeric scale, like a Likert scale. So the coach network, I don't know anybody there. So no, I don't have one. Or yeah, the coach, the person who'll win if we win and wants me to win, he's the decision maker. I got an in. This is great, right? There's all kinds of things in between. We once it's in a numerical scale, it's like a check sheet in a factory. You can, salespeople, anybody should be able to look at a situation. And if you've done these observable characteristics correctly, they'd all say the same thing. They all make the same observations, right? I don't have a coach. I have a coach, but they don't have any influence. I have a coach. They have a little influence, but not really very much. You know, you let the salespeople define what the things are that they're looking for, right? And you now you have a way to assess, given the theory that the salespeople have put out there, you have a numerical comparison, right? And you don't just do coaches. You do the extent of their need. You do presence of competition, their urgency, all kinds of things you come up with, right? Now, you've just operationally defined, you've helped the sales team come up with the first ever operational definition of what observable things would enable the deals to be more or less likely to buy. First thing that happens, you have the salespeople apply these to their deals, and you come up, you can prioritize the deals, so the highest score is theoretically the highest quality. So the first thing that starts happening is it's not what salespeople expected. Man, I thought that big account that I just found, that's a really good account. I thought it would be high on the list. Well, no, not according to your operational definition. It's not. Salespeople compare. Oh, I see. I don't know the answer to that. I need to start answering that question because they came up with what they should be looking for. So they're motivated to start operating in a more consistent way, right? Because of this. Then the next thing that happens is it's the most accurate forecast indicator they've ever had. It's routine for people to be at 35 or 45% forecast accuracy. Now they're up 75 or 80% forecast accuracy. Okay.
I could see a situation though that where anecdotes become, are driving the characteristics. You know, so for instance, one person, found out that if there's competition in there, that's important to note. Well, we all know that's important to note. But what if it was some other obscure thing that was in the value chain that led to a significant sale? Even though it might not, even though it was a one-off and it's not used in any other sale, it might end up being in the process because anecdotally, it was in the successful process once.
Okay.
So how do we keep our processes from getting out of control? Because I could see this thing getting out of control really, really fast.
Well, and it actually, the opposite is what happens. So here's an example. Now that we have the equivalent of a check sheet, we have the first draft of a method of comparing and determining and comparing, measuring, if you will, the quality of the sales opportunities. And over a period of time, as you collect more data from more deals, and you can now do statistical analysis on the ones that you won, you lost, you went to no decision. right? When we've done this with clients, inevitably a couple of things start happening. We came up with way too many questions in the beginning, and the data shows us, you know, of those 32 questions, only 12 are really relevant. And of those, these 8 are really relevant. But, ooh, that coaching question, you know, you thought a higher score would make it more likely to buy? Uh-uh, it's a lower score. Well, that's got a professional sales manager scratching his head. What the heck? How could that be? In one of my clients, here's how it could be. They had hired professional respiratory therapists because they were selling respirators, right? The machines that breathe for you in a hospital if you can't breathe. They weren't professional salespeople. So to the word coach to them, they just assumed it was like people in their old company where they used to work, right? Oh, well, the few people in the sales force who were professional salespeople were interpreting it differently. The most of these, we need to do a little training and clarify this question. Well, there were 3 or 4 questions that were like that. So now we have a new iteration of our operational definition, and we've learned from it. We've eliminated all the other questions that don't matter, but we're using data, right, to tell us. It's guiding us. So you're actually simplifying the process, and you're making it work better. And the salespeople are paying attention to this thing because they realize that whatever's on the high score on that list is actually they're going to buy. I mean, that's good for the salespeople. And if they have a low score and they can't find a way to increase it on a given account, that gives them a reason to walk away. And that's just, I mean, that is just one important example, but it's just one. That same client realized after a while that there was a different profile of these hospitals in the suburbs, the rich, well-funded teaching hospitals, versus the inner city hospitals. The reason that they bought things was very different, right? Oh, we need different qualification criteria. Now you're getting even more slick, right? You can market to people according to what's important to them. It also happens with regard to the customer's journey. What are the stages that the customers go through? In that particular industry, the oxygen and respiratory, you know, ventilators, there are just, in most hospitals, they are just part of the utilities. They can't even bill for it, right? It just has to be there. So that makes it hard to cost justify a fleet of new machines. The old ones could have the wheels falling off and be getting rusty, but the respiratory therapy department might not be very comfortable going into the carpeted areas of the hospital and talking to people, right? So it was hard for them to find qualified leads. So it turned out several of the salespeople had in their back pocket, because they had been respiratory therapists, the way that they did it. The company could have put those people together to come up with some sort of a standard template and then offered that to people. Because when I did, I was in the very beginning of the engagement, I was doing some voice of customer with them, and they would bring some of their customers in. And I started picking up about this thing about it's difficult to justify these deals, and the respiratory therapy managers definitely want to be able to do that. So when I mentioned that if there was a template to use, every single one of those customers, they're leaning back in the chair and they lean forward, right? So that was one of the really good ideas we started working on to help improve that lead generation process. And I mean, today with the internet and the things that are available with technology, there's just so much that can be done. But you have to be looking for, you have to recognize that your sales process has to be engineered around getting people to take the actions you want them to take. Right, right. That's your cause and effect. Did I answer your question?
Yes. Yes, you did. So, you know, we've been, this is very heady stuff, and it's very intertwined. It's very complicated. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. All right. I'm going to have you take this word salad that we've been sharing and indulging with this evening. And I need you to distill it down to a couple of nuggets that our audience can action today. Is there anything that you could precipitate out of what we've discussed that says, this is what you should do, this is what you should look for, this is my advice to you, anything like that?
Well, there's a ton. I mean, to me, there's a couple of fundamental things that turn on its head a lot of the assumptions, not just in process improvement, but in sales and marketing, okay? You can operationally define value. right? Once you understand that value is that which we act to gain or keep. If you do something, you're trying to get a customer to take actions and they don't do it, you're creating waste. You haven't figured out what they want, right? If you're doing it and they take the action, you've created value. But you have to design, and salespeople kind of do it by instinct, like we said before, you know, they know they got to get his attention and his, earn his trust and all that. But when you're in an organization and you have the internet and the customer's looking out on the internet for stuff, it's the whole company that, right, that has to be a salesperson-like, right? It has to be offering things at the various stages of where the customer might be to engage them. And we can measure that stuff way better than we ever could before.
Yeah, but where if I was a salesperson or if I was a company, where would I begin? What would the first, what would be a, the first action on the first day?
Go look for a sales VP to work for who has systemic thinking and wants to engage in continuous improvement. That's what
okay.
you should
do. And so what are some of the telltales? How would I know if I actually found that person?
Well, they would, looking at it from my perspective now, I would be looking for some, and I do this when talking to people who are prospective clients. You need a company that respects the ideas of reason and logic, and most of those are expounded through some form of operational excellence, right? Respect for people, right? You expect people to take ownership. You give them the freedom to make mistakes. You support them. You make sure that everybody is paying attention to the evidence and the data, and you ask them why they think this or that, right? I'm less comfortable with people who are trying to impose best practices. Yes, there are better ways to earn someone's trust. Yes, there are good things about how to build presentations and come up with value proposition. No question about it. But value is contextual. It depends on the nature of the people that you're talking to. And not every customer or prospect is going to be good at understanding their own internal costs. So you have to approach them differently. And that is the skill that you need a sales force for, right? So we always think about selling as what salespeople do. And I dislike that because the whole company needs to be doing it. And we need to be designing all of our interactions, our web page, our presence in conferences, as well as the way salespeople do it. And we need to automate it as much as possible so that you only can put salespeople in the places that can't be automated. That's what you need them for. If salespeople were fed high quality prospects on a regular basis and they didn't have to waste their time, you know, knocking on doors as much, the whole sales organization, and if they're the right kind of customers, you're elevating the performance of the whole business. Some famous sales executives, who turned consultants and trainers have said, and they were absolutely right, my experience, that, you know, most of the salespeople in the company right now are working overtime to bring in customers that we do not want. Because nobody ever told them what a qualified prospect was. That is not something that can be edicted from on high. You can't tell them to go start selling solutions instead and expect anything to happen.
Right.
You have to engage with them. What do they see? What do they think the problems are? And what do they think the solutions are? And then when it makes sense, everybody's got to agree, try a change, actually make a change.
Right.
And see what happens and then go from there. And when people are able to do that and make changes, be they qualification criteria or whatever it is, and it starts working, they are invested. They own it. They get enthusiastic. I can't tell you how many times I've been invited in by the president of a company and he's nervous or she's nervous, right? Because it's process stuff and these people they're allergic to process. And we get in and start working with the people and they're so happy. Finally, we get to start working on these problems that we've known have been here for ages. This is great. I mean, they love it. They're itching for it. People aren't really allergic to process. They're allergic to bad management. They're allergic to people forcing them to do stuff that doesn't make sense to them. And that's this whole disconnect in the culture, I guess, between sales and it doesn't need to be that way.
So you've written a couple of books, at least a couple, right? I'm aware of two. Have you written more than two?
No.
Okay.
Arguably, okay. I could be working on another one right now, but don't tell my wife.
So let's talk about your books. Specifically, this is an opportunity, of course, for you to plug your books, but I'd like to start with the oldest one, its title and why you wrote it, and then the second one, its title and why you wrote it, and of course, what you hope the reader gets out of their investment in time and treasure in reading both of these books.
So I was a professional sales trainer for 8 years, I think, going on actually close to 10, I think. I went independent from them after a while. And it was a great experience. And I learned a huge amount in doing that. But for me, the management consulting part of it was the important part, the interesting part. I had, during that period of time, studied with the American Society for Quality and got certified as a quality manager. I had, previous to that, become certified in production and inventory control. That's where I was able to see the parallels between what you have to do in production and what you have to do in sales and marketing. And so when I went independent, they kept bringing me back in to do, that's how I got my start, to do work for them, because I knew how to do process mapping, and they were able to kind of add that to the sales training and customer value mapping. How do you create, again, operational definition of what does this executive or head of this department value, and how do you know that? And once you know what they value and what their problems are, what do you do with it? What questions should you ask, right? That's a very powerful kind of a take. So I built some of these things. They had me coming in to do this. But along the side, Six Sigma was getting really popular. And so I started following the bulletin boards. This is in the early 2000s.
Yes.
And got involved, helped them to organize the first Six Sigma conferences, right? And they wanted to do them in sales and marketing. The first ones in sales and marketing, right? Funny story. We did the first one. It was about 53 people, I think, who came. And more than half the speakers came from my Rolodex. I'm helping this conference company in the UK, right? So 6 months later, they wanted to do another one. And they said, would you like to help us organize that? And I said, sure. They said, okay, that'll be $1,800. I go, what? Wait a second. So anyway, we survived that. But after doing that for a while, I was approached by a company to write a book, and I wasn't going to turn that down.
Okay.
What's the title? That was Sales and Marketing, Sales and Marketing the Six Sigma Way. Came out about a year and a half later. Okay.
Okay.
I cashed in my 401k account to pay for the best business book co-author I could find, writer, because I'm not a professional writer. Six Sigma has some arcane stuff in it. I mean, it's not an easy thing to figure out. And here I'm going to be talking to basic guys, right? Salespeople as sales managers. I needed to make sure that I could do it. And it turned out very well. Sales and Marketing, the Six Sigma Way, sold probably 22,000 copies. It's still selling at a trickle all around the world. And it's because I was able to take this production mindset and explain it in a way that makes sense to salespeople, mm-hmm. and identifying the points of measurement. But it was the first attempt. And it was after that book was published when I started getting some really good engagements, where I'm engaged at the top of the organization, helping the president of the company and the vice presidents of sales and getting things organized. That's when I really started learning. And some people came alongside me who were interested in this, some of them from a technical operational excellence background. Some of them are my buddies from the sales training company. And things went really well, but the business went up. And then, like a lot of them, it went down after a few years.
Okay.
And I realized why that was happening. Go ahead.
So the first book, Sales and Marketing, the Six Sigma Way, is that what you said? Mm-hmm. And what did you hope that the reader would get out of it?
What I hope that they would get out of it is that this stuff can help salespeople. I mean, that's what I wrote it for. But you just have to look at sales differently. You can't look at it like everybody go sell. That guy can, that guy can't. Let's get more of those guys and none of these guys, without analyzing why. Also, salespeople are struggling. What's the cause of the struggle? Because sometimes it ain't in the sales department, right? And a lot of senior executives at the time, more maybe than now, I'm not sure, they would sort of have this mentality, well, if the sales department isn't making its numbers, it must be a problem in the sales department. Well,
right.
May or may not be true, but you've got, there's data and evidence. There's ways to be logical and respectful.
Okay, so now I'm getting something out of this that Six Sigma, we're looking at variations, we're looking at defects. All right. And so a defect for not making a sales number, a defect could be because we're out of stock.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Okay. We're out of stock. Okay. Maybe we didn't hit our numbers because of a currency fluctuation. Maybe we didn't hit our numbers because of one of a million different reasons. But now we can isolate those reasons based on our forecast and treat them as defects to reconcile what our expectation was versus the reality. And so now I'm getting that. Now I got
it. That's right. So in that book, I believe it's chapter 4, after I had introduced the basics of what Six Sigma is, I had done a project, a whole detailed project on a website. It was a website that offered assistance actually for Six Sigma trained people to get a job, right? It was a job search kind of a website. So we were studying the pages and the traffic on the pages, and I interviewed people, and I realized that what people wanted to know wasn't explained on these pages. And so when we figured that out, we changed the pages, and you could measure the improvement in throughput. It was like more than double improvement, right? And so I had to prove it to the Six Sigma community, as well as to the sales community, that this stuff is important and it works, right? So it's a pretty detailed project and all the calculations that we had to go through to do that. Sure. And that was chapter 4 of the book. And after that, we talk about cases, and it's a very good introduction to the topic. But I realized over time that what was happening is a bunch of things. The sales executives and company presidents would still kind of look at things as, well, it's a project. So how much return am I going to get on this project? Mm-hmm.
Right,
well, you know what? You can't even measure your sales process now, so I can't tell you the answer to that. That doesn't make it easier to sell, right? But the executives, they didn't understand what process improvement, you know, why did sales and marketing need process improvement? They didn't understand that. And how does process improvement or operational excellence change and improve sales and marketing management? Right? They didn't understand those things. So I needed to go deeper. And that was the new book. The first one is primarily green on the cover. The second one is primarily, first one is primarily blue on the cover. The second one's green on the cover.
Okay, so
and it was
the green one. You wrote a second book, and so what's its title? And who is its? What would the reader get out of it?
Okay, Sales and Marketing: The Six Sigma Way. Is that backwards to you?
Nope, it looks great to me.
Okay, and then Sales Process Excellence. By the way, this one earned a Shingo Research Award.
Ah, awesome. Okay? Awesome.
So you could look at Sales and Marketing the Six Sigma Way as kind of an introductory book. If you know nothing about the industry, you would still get value out of that. But what I wanted to do was to write a definitive, a textbook, essentially, because the industry is just crying out for better analytical processes to improve and make salespeople's lives so much better. Mm-hmm. And it needs it. And there's so much that you can do. So I figured if I was the top of the hill and had the most thorough explanation of how you can, use data and evidence to increase customer value, accelerate your sales funnel, and grow your business, that there would be demand for that.
Right? All right. So what are you hoping that the reader gets out of that?
Well, this one is more written for practitioners, or people inside of the company, a company that already respects process improvement in some way and wants to be serious about taking it to sales and marketing, right? That's what this is for, because there's just a huge need for it. And it gives you kind of the step-by-step and goes into, there's more than 45 case examples in there. And in the appendix, there's a whole list of not just process improvement tools, if you need an explanation of those, but sales process excellence tools, right? Stuff that is uniquely set up and designed for the sales B2B kind of sales environment, right?
All right.
And so while It's hard to earn a shingle award. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, well, it's remarkable. Congratulations on that. Yeah. That's
it's the only B2B sales and marketing book that's ever won the award.
Yeah, I was thinking it would probably be true.
Yeah, and so the world hasn't beaten a path to my door yet.
Right.
So, but it is out there, and it's helpful to people who want to take it serious.
Right. So, just to put on our futurism hat, you know, we have the internet, and we have these bots, and we have AI, and all right, it's a crazy, fast moving world out there. What do you think is going to happen in the next 5 years with all these different tools and how fast they're evolving? And it seems like the people are getting out of the process more and more. I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. What are your predictions?
Well, one of the opportunities I see, I have been spending a considerable amount of time recently in, teaching myself how to use a no-code database. Pretty impressed with the capabilities that are there. The reason I started doing it is because I'm involved in my homeowners association here, and they don't have any centralized accounting system. Everybody's using spreadsheets to track, you know, $500,000 in landscape expenses in a year and you know, other things for building and roads. And every time they has their own spreadsheet and they go away from the meeting, and now the spreadsheet's out of date and there's no central. Anyway, so working on configuring that. But what I'm realizing as I do that is that the traditional approaches, especially in CRM systems, are very top down and not at all designed to get feedback and learn. So most of them, in fact, you're supposed to tell it in advance what the conversion rate is from step one to step two to step three of your sales process. You would never do that in manufacturing because you want to know what it is. You don't want to put blinders on the executives to say, well, we just right. give it a rule of thumb. No, we want to measure it, right? There's all sorts of things. Once you pour concrete in the CRM, it's damn hard to change it. Mm-hmm. With these no-code systems, you can edit them. You change them on the fly, right? So, for example, that example that we did, I talked about before with the ventilator company, you have a numerical way to measure and analyze the sales, the quality of the content of the sales funnel. And you learn that, oh, I was understanding it incorrectly. I need a new way to write this question. I need new, better observable characteristics. But you just change it and you can move forward. These systems are meant to enable you to do that. Likewise, because to me, the reason process excellence works at all is that it respects reason, right? Scientific kind of approach. What do we see? What can we identify about it? What can we predict about it? Does that work, right? And engineering schools and, you know, operational excellence is sort of built on that. It's easier to apply that in physical production.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to apply it. You either do it intuitively or you do it scientifically, repeatedly in commercial endeavors. And you can, and you should. And because you have to focus on creating the value instead of eliminating the waste. And that's like a Geiger counter telling you where the market is going
okay.
to be.
So, but this is, you know, I'm again looking futuristically here. I came across an app a couple of days ago that would teach me Italian. And what it does is it listens to me, the app listens to me and has a conversation with me. Okay. So I could ask it, you know, how are you? How's your day going? And it would give me a response in Italian. Okay.
Nice.
And I could then, you know, give another response in Italian or my pidgin Italian. And it would give me, you know, so now we're having a conversation. All right. It's a contextual conversation. It's not Sally, Dick, and Jane. You know, see Dick run. You know, see Sally run. It's having a conversation. So extrapolating this out a little bit further, right? You know, we're talking about salespeople. We're talking about relationships. All right. Are people, customers, going to have conversations with AI bots?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
But I would argue that just like with when the internet started really taking off, there was a huge population of people in salespeople in travel agencies, and their job could be done better by a web page.
Right.
So they were out of a job, right?
Right.
And so but slowly those sales pages have gotten more and more sophisticated. And I think artificial intelligence is going to enable people to, you'd have a bot, and if they're good, be able to have the earlier, simpler sales process, the earlier, maybe beginning phases of things. However, those things have an Achilles heel because they have to be trained on whatever's currently been written. They're not going to come up with any new brilliant idea. Only human beings can identify the essential characteristics of something in reality and come up with a new theory that will actually be better.
Well,
bots are going to just repeat what they've read before.
Well, that assumes that that limitation can't be overcome. But I could actually see a day where procurement has a procurement bot has a conversation with a sales rep bot, and people aren't even involved.
Well, potentially. I mean, there's people buying million-dollar complicated boilers off of a spec on the internet right now with no salespeople talking to each other. That is all feasible. But I'll tell you this. Those companies that are able to capture the real words that their prospects and customers use and their salespeople use, and then able to abstract from that the essential arguments, if you will, the essential value propositions, the essential things that sales needs to know before they start opening their mouth and talking about the product, right? They're going to have much better ability to configure these artificial intelligence systems. This stuff isn't going to invent itself.
Right.
This is going to take a lot of iteration with a lot of smart people learning how to prompt and program these AIs. I don't think it's going to eliminate, it's going to change the kind of jobs we have. I don't see it as it's going to eliminate it. But you're to a point you made earlier, we're all living creatures. The point I made earlier, you made it too. We need to trust each other, right? We need to have evidence that tells us we should trust each other, right? And we earn that by interactions. I hate the bots that the websites force on us right now because they don't even pay attention to what you're saying.
Right.
I mean, you could do that if you make an AI and make it more elaborate. It's just going to do that on steroids unless you have designed it very carefully to pick up what it can learn about the other person and bring a real person in, you know, really quickly when things start going south.
Right, right, right.
But I don't think that's, I mean, yes, that's a future, but there's so much we need to learn and understand about how the mind works. And I'm not saying that we don't know how the mind works. I'm saying that good executives and good salespeople do, but it's intuitive.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to understand, well, I have this emotion. That must mean I value that, but I shouldn't value that, right? Being self-aware. Or that customer thinks he values this. How can I get him to see that that's not what is really valuable, right? And doing that kind of thing effectively, that is salesmanship. And if you just leave it up to people, everybody go sell, figure out for yourself how to do it, you know, you're missing out on opportunities to help people learn from where they are to where everybody else is. You're elevating the standard of the whole organization by taking, you have to respect what do people think and why they think it. That's the most important thing an executive can do. Because if his people are actively thinking and learning, his organization is going to be much more successful. It's going to be much more ready for the challenges, to the point of your book, right? But we have to be conscious of, and we have to study and respect reason and why people do things. And it's not about making them do it your way. It's about getting them to teach you a better way to do it.
Right, right. Well, listen, Michael, I really appreciate you taking the time today and sharing your insights and wisdom gained over so many years. I found it incredibly interesting that, you know, you started in manufacturing with a deep understanding of manufacturing processes and then adapted them to sales and marketing activities. And I think that anybody that's looking to try to create standards and measuring opportunities should definitely reach out to you and grab a copy of your books.
Yeah, this one for a long time was only privately published, the Sales and Sales Process Excellence, and it's recently been available on Amazon. And so we'll put a link in your show notes.
Absolutely.
I think we're going to try to do an article for your newsletter as well.
Super.
And so, yeah, I mean, if there's follow-on questions, I'd be curious what people think.
Very good. Well, again, Michael, thank you for taking the time today. It's been a great pleasure having you.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.